Okay, we are starting our second day, Friday. We're starting just a few minutes late. Lyle is working on getting the Ustream working. He said the audio is going up. If you don't see what's out there on video, hopefully we'll be able to correct that. The files will definitely be up later. I sent an email out to everybody before class this evening, reminding them of where to go to BufordCoc.com, clicking the Watch Live link. Incidentally, when you click the Watch Live link, there's also a link there to access past videos. And so the most recent ones are there, but they haven't been fully edited or archived yet, so they may move in a different place. But I did send an email out. Did everybody here get the email? If you didn't check it, you should have gotten an email. And it'll have links to how to stream, but it'll also mention that all the audio, video, and all the handouts and everything that we did yesterday, they're all already up on the site. I mentioned this already, but I'll repeat it again. I mentioned in the email, the video files that I record, that I'm recording now with my laptop, they're huge, and so they have to be downsized before they go up, but they're still between 1.5 to 2 gigabytes in size when I load them. So it takes a while to load. So I literally had to go by University of North Georgia's campus to have decent internet speed to do that. So tonight's audio will be up probably before I leave tonight, but tonight's video won't be up till later. And then tomorrow, because we'll be here all day from 9 till noon, then take a lunch break till 1, and then till 4, all the stuff that will be recorded tomorrow, I won't be able to get up till Sunday. And it's just simply because they're just huge files and it takes me a while to load. So this material will all be up eventually. So be patient with us if you don't mind, and we'll get all of that done. So I want to very, very quickly mention what we did yesterday. I'm not going to open up the chart because I'm afraid if I do so, I'll spend too much time looking at it. But in the chart that we looked at yesterday, which is the Bible period chart, we reviewed biblical periods of history, starting with the period going before the flood, going all the way through to the time of Christ and the beginning of the preaching of the kingdom and the establishment of the kingdom. And if you go back up in the bottom of that chart, you'll see the last two things during the Old Testament age dealing with the period when the kingdom was divided, and then when Judah existed alone, and then finally the Babylonian captivity, and the one immediately after that was the intertestamental period. That's what we're dealing with. So we're dealing with a period of time that starts roughly 536 years prior to the time of Christ, and that's going to continue. That is the Second Temple period until 70 AD. So what I mentioned repeatedly yesterday, and this is where I want to start, is what we see in the period right before the intertestamental period is the Jews going through a huge do-over. Everything that was started at Mount Sinai is restarting. Now, there's some significant difference. The differences are when they left Sinai, they were under God's divine protection, and God blessed them to remove them from the nation of Egypt. Now God's blessed them to allow them to come back into the land of Canaan, but totally different circumstances. They were oppressed not because of their sin in Egypt, but they were oppressed because of their sin in Assyrian captivity and then in Babylonian captivity. And so when they came back, figures that we see at one point are only about 20-some thousand people that come back in the first departure from Babylon, coming back to the land of Canaan. But there were multiplied millions of people leaving the land of Egypt. So we got totally different populations, obviously nearly 1,000 years apart, totally different populations. But the scale is so much different. The other thing is, when they came into the land, the period of judges and the period of kings, they had a system that was in place, an infrastructure in place. God helped them drive out the inhabitants of the land. Now when they come back, the inhabitants are pretty much scattered all over the place, especially the Jews. And the people that are left there, there's no infrastructure. The Canaanites aren't in the land like they were 1,000 years before. So this is not only a major do-over from the standpoint of re-entering the land, but they're entering the land in much worse adverse conditions than when we saw when they came into the land the first time 1,000 years ago. So very quickly, if you look, there's starting point in each of these statements. From the time of Moses and the Exodus and the time they were at Mount Sinai, which is when the law was given, to Saul, 450 to 500 years. To the time that Israel fell, 750 to 800 years. To the time that Judah fell, and it's Judah that's in captivity in Babylon, about 900 to 920 years. to the start of the restoration period, all right, which is right before the intertestamental period. That's almost 1,000 years, all right? And so the temple's not going to be built until 20 years after that. And so for the better part of a millennium, the Jewish people had lived under the auspices of the Old Testament law, the temple, the priestly system, and all that sort of thing. So now they're going to restart everything. And so we're almost at the edge of the period of restoration and getting into that period that's technically the intertestamental period. You might say, well, why don't we just start with the intertestamental period? Just start from scratch. Well, let me just say, pick a war. Pick World War I, World War II, Vietnam War, Korean War, whatever. Is there history behind that that helps us understand what happens in the context of that war? Obviously, Revolutionary War, any particular period in history that's significant, there's going to be a history that precedes that, that prompted whatever period of history you're talking about. And so for us to understand the intertestamental period, we need to understand all those circumstances that were in play that developed in the last couple of centuries before the intertestamental period, because that's going to impact what we see when we get into the heart of it, and it's also going to impact what we see when we get into the context of the New Testament. Because what starts now is going to hang around for half a millennium, and it's going to impact the ministry of John, that is John the Baptizer, John the Baptist, in the ministry of Jesus. It's also going to impact the work of the early church. So here's the discouragement that we mentioned before. No king. There's no Saul, there's no David, there's no Solomon, there's no Rehoboam, there's not any kings in the north, there's not any kings in the south, no king. And so the prophets in large measure prophesy, most of the prophets prophesy in a 300-year window right before, up to, and shortly after the period of the captivities in the north and then in the south. That doesn't mean there aren't any prophets after that. Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, we're going to make reference to those in the context of our class. Those are post-exilic, that is after the exile prophets, but most of the prophets existed before. So they don't have the direct direct message from God that they had from the prophets before. So the nation's nowhere the size that it was. It's not a world-impressive nation like it was during the days of David and Solomon. People aren't coming to pay tribute to the land of Israel. In fact, one of the things that we're going to see repeatedly in the intertestamental period was that different rulers in the land would end up paying tribute to others. So why are they still around? If you read through the book of Isaiah, you see about 20-some chapters or so, starting in the early teens in the book of Isaiah and going up to the early 30s. You see, God pronounces judgment against almost every nation on the planet at that time. And when God pronounces judgment upon them, much of the judgment he pronounces upon them is final. That nation's not going to come back to be what it was. But God pledges, going back to the time of Isaiah, this is hundreds of years before what we're dealing with now. So Isaiah's a prophet roughly 750 years prior to the time of Christ. We're now about 540 to 550 years prior to the time of Christ. So there's 200-year difference. Isaiah says God's going to bring you back. God will take you away, but God will bring you back. Jeremiah says, in effect, the same sort of thing. Why is God saying that? Because there's a remnant. So there's leftover seed remnant theology. You see it all over the book of Isaiah. Isaiah talks about a root that's going to spring up from the tribe of Jesse, from the tribe of Judah. That refers to Jesse's son David. And you see all this language talks about something that's almost as if it's dead, but nonetheless there's some element of life in it. So this remnant theology, God's saying a leftover, sufficient number of people, a sufficient number of leftover people is going to come back to this place, and it's going to keep the dream of leading to the Messiah alive. So God's keeping them alive for salvation purposes coming through the Messiah. That's going to be accomplished another 500 years down the future. So they didn't dissolve. Israel didn't save the world. God saved the world through the Messiah, but Israel was supposed to be a standard bearer, a banner of that message about messianic coming and what was going to be accomplished through that. So God had a message for them. So in addition to that, God's going to scatter them everywhere. We mentioned in other passages yesterday that Moses prophesied that in the book of Deuteronomy, the fourth chapter earliest, and then towards the end of the book as well. The Jews are going to be scattered. Most of the Jews did not come back. Most of the Jews are scattered all over the Mediterranean area, the ancient Near East, all around the borders of the Mediterranean Sea, in Spain, in Italy, in Greece, in Macedonia, in Asia Minor, what we know to be modern Turkey, all in areas on the eastern side of the land of Palestine, the Sinai Peninsula, and Egypt. They're just scattered everywhere. So very few of them come back. So that's why when we get to the book of Acts, at the second chapter, we see people coming from all over the place to kick back in into the system of worship that's the end of the Old Testament system, but the beginning of the New Testament system when the gospel is preached on the day of Pentecost. All right, so we went through all these things before, and here's the outline that we started with. So we were almost at the end of Jerusalem Arises from the Ashes. So we did a lot of introductory material. We just went through that very, very quickly. You spent much more time on it yesterday. And we talked about the actual return. We're talking about the resurrection of Jerusalem, which is going to be the principal city politically, economically, and religiously during the period of the intertestamental period. And then we're going to get into the world empire. So we're hopefully going to get at least close to the Romans are coming and finish that tomorrow. And then tomorrow morning we'll finish the Romans are coming and Herod rules. And then part of the description in the catalog is dealing with the writings of Scripture. If we have time, we'll allude to some of the things about key players. But that's add-on if we get that far. So we're going to take up where we left off last time, dealing with the Jerusalem arising from the ashes. So I'm going to scroll really far down here, and this is the beginning of this period that we started yesterday. And let me make that a little bit bigger on the screen so people who can watch it or in the class can see it. So the key leaders, is that big enough for everybody to see? Mm-hmm. All right. So the key leaders, the first one we talked about was Nehemiah. And the next one we're going to talk about is Ezra. They're not the only key leaders. Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah are the three key leaders. We already talked about Nehemiah, and we want to talk about Ezra. And as we scroll down to where we left off yesterday and we start talking about Ezra, we're going to see that Ezra was very unique in what he did. First of all, Ezra was a priest. And because of Ezra's role as a priest, he had a very particular spiritual impact on the redo that we talked about before. So remember, the temple system was gone. Why? The children of Israel weren't faithful in their service to God using the temple, and the priesthood system was gone. It wasn't in practice anymore for 70 years. Why? They weren't doing what God wanted. And so when they're in the period of captivity, there's no temple. And even if they were in the city of Jerusalem 20 years into the captivity, the temple was destroyed. And so it was left in ruins. And so there was no job for the priest to do, even if they were back in Jerusalem and Judah, because of the temple's destruction. So things are changed. All of that had to restart. It starts when the people come back and they rebuild the temple. There's a delay of 20-some years. And then they have to rebuild not only the temple, but the walls of the city. And that's part of what Nehemiah was involved in. But most important was they had to restart the whole spiritual system. Building the temple didn't make the spiritual system start by itself. That's what they had to start next. All right. So here's what I want us to focus on for the next few minutes is what Ezra was going to do. Nehemiah concentrated on temporal things, social issues, rebuilding the wall, dealing with the issue of usury, the Jews, you know, enslaving each other and charging incredible high interest and taking advantage of each other. That had to be fixed. And so Nehemiah is going to deal with that. Ezra is going to focus more so on religious changes. So here's what's interesting. Ezra shows up on the scene 107 or so years after Cyrus's decree. So it took almost 20 years or so for the temple to be rebuilt. So we're talking 80 years after the temple was rebuilt, and the religious system that the priests were supposed to be involved in, all their services, all their duties, the sacrificial system, the order, that still wasn't straightened out. So we're a century after the restoration, and it still hasn't been fixed. So this is not strictly in the period between the Testaments, but it's going to impact it, as we're going to see. So physical rebuilding the city wall, that's going to have to be done and strengthened. This priestly system has been going on, but it wasn't functioning the way it needed to be. And the problems are going to be exacerbated as we go further about what's going to happen between the priests and the rest of the people. All right, so Nehemiah was commissioned by the Persian court. Cyrus was a Persian king, allowed all the peoples to go back, not just the Jews. And we're going to see as you go further into the history that the Persians not only allowed them to go back, but they gave them orders to reestablish their religious systems that were in practice before they were in captivity, and even financed some of these forays into rebuilding. So Ezra also has permission from the Persian court to come back, but his job is to kick back into gear in the fullest possible way the system that was first started at Sinai. So when we went back before, we used the word redo repeatedly. What started at Sinai nearly 1,000 years before had to start all over again. So he was a priest. And he was a scribe. And we're going to see that even though he was in captivity when he came back, he was still fluent and versed in Hebrew. Because when he spoke in Hebrew, the text tells us that in the book of Nehemiah chapter 8, not everybody was able to do that. And translation had to be excuse me, given by other of the Levites in order to help the people who were there. And so he was still steadfast in knowing that language. All right, so when he gathers together, he gets into the city of Jerusalem, he gathers the people together, and he's going to teach God's will. So this is chronicled in the book of Nehemiah, and I don't want to turn to that and read it, I just want to highlight it here. So here's what's taking place. Everybody gathers together, and Ezra's going to read from the book of the law. And he's going to start early in the morning. By the way, there's a special wooden platform, a pulpit, if you will, that he's standing on, and he starts in the morning, and the people stand, and they're there standing until he finishes the reading, and it takes till about midday. So multiple hours they're listening to Ezra read the book of the law of the Lord, and as he's reading, people are in and amongst the crowd interpreting what he's reading from Hebrew into Aramaic and giving that sense so that they can understand what he's doing. So the people are standing. So we just mentioned this before. Nehemiah chapter 8 says that other priests are involved in helping him translate this so people can understand it. Hebrew was what they normally spoke before they went into captivity, but something changed. We mentioned this before. Generations change. Gave the illustration. My mom's mother came from southern Germany. My grandfather came from Switzerland. They all spoke German. And the first generation, my mom and her sisters, all spoke German. But it fades quickly. The next generation didn't need it. Why? Because they didn't have to deal with ancestors who came from Europe. They were dealing with ancestors who were raised in America. So that fades off. So these people are no longer in the land. And so they're not speaking the original language like they used to. So that was the dominant language. That's going to change. So Ezra's reading the law. And people hear the law and they're going to cry. They're weeping, saying, oh, these are all these things God wants us to do, and we need to put these into practice. Just a reminder, the impact that we see here is not the fullest impact that it should have had. When when the book of the law of the Lord was discovered in the temple during the reign of Josiah, Josiah wept, and he went about implementing everything. Well, here the people are weeping because they realize that there's an obligation they have to do what their ancestors didn't do, which landed them into captivity. So now that they're restarting, they're going to have to put that into practice themselves. But later they're going to see just how much it involves. All right. So one of the things we did yesterday with the lessons from Leviticus, and incidentally all those files that you asked about, those are already up. The impact on the lesson from Leviticus is the law touched every aspect of life. Every aspect of life by design. Well, now they're going to see just how far-reaching the impact of the law is. So as they are putting into practice what God wants them to do. They're going to keep the feast of the tabernacles. And during the course of the feast, Ezra didn't just read that one day in Nehemiah chapter 8, the beginning of the chapter, but he's going to continue to read on a regular basis as they're going through the course of the feast. So one of the things that they're going to have to do is they're going to have to observe rules of holiness, purity and cleanliness, spiritually speaking, ceremonially keeping, that was in play before they went into captivity. And so that was going to require some of the people not to have anything to do with nations around them. That was an issue that had plagued them in the past, as well as making sure that they followed dietary restrictions, anything and everything that was unclean. So they're going to have to keep the Sabbath. They're going to have to keep up their support to the temple. They're not supposed to be involved in marrying foreign people from foreign places. There were prescriptions about that. And that is the last thing we mentioned as we ended last time, as Nehemiah addressed that. Well, Ezra's going to address it again. What's the problem? This is a very oversimplification, but the kingdom split because of Solomon's sins of marrying not only lots of different women, some of those were political and business economic arrangements, but because he allowed them to influence him to worship other gods. That is, he supported them. He financed some of their false systems of belief and so forth. And that's the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, 1 Kings chapter 11. God's going to split the kingdom during the time of his son Rehoboam rather than during the, Solomon's time for the sake of his father David. And so that whole issue of who you connect with in business, in marriage, and other social things, that's going to demand a lot more attention. So some of the Jews were intent on maintaining their relationships with the non-Jews, economically, socially, and so forth. And so Ezra's going to pray about that. And he's going to encourage them, say, you can't do what God doesn't want you to do. So we mentioned before, I made reference, this was pointed out to me by Pat. I said Genesis 5, and it said Genesis 4, with reference to Lamech. It's Genesis 4:19. That says Lamech took two wives, and God took note of that. Why? Because it was violation of what God initially intended. In the closing verses of Genesis 2, 23 and following.
It would really be the first time that's mentioned.
It is the first time it's mentioned. Yeah. It was, and here's the thing. God gave a prescription as to what he wanted them to follow in Genesis 2, and two chapters later, the first time that there's a step away from that, the text simply says he did it. Doesn't say good, doesn't say bad, just says he did it. But the point that it's recorded, the people who would have been reading for that for the first time, Moses' contemporaries, they would have said, oh, look what God said about this that happened near the beginning. That's going to come into play during Moses' writings, Moses' time as well in Deuteronomy 24.
So the reading of the law that you just talked about.
That's right. This is Ezra reading it as part of the whole redo.
Was it like all day long?
Well, the beginning of this is at least a half a day, but that was only one of the days.
Yeah.
He was reading on a regular basis during the course of the feast. So if it was consistent as it was the first day this described the beginning of the chapter, it was a few hours each day. There are questions as to how much he read. Did he read all of Genesis through Deuteronomy? Sometimes the Book of the Law is a shorthand for reading the Book of Deuteronomy. That's what summed up the essence of the law. From Genesis through Numbers is summed up in the book of Deuteronomy. It's retold. That's why it's called Deuteronomy, second giving of the law. And so sometimes it's assumed that that's what he read. So, you know, that's not going to be anywhere near as much as reading all of the law from Genesis through that. But the point is,
they stood up.
They stood up. They listened.
They raised their hands.
The meanings were given to them in Hebrew and then in their language that they were more familiar with in Aramaic to make sure they understood what was going on. But he didn't just read it to read it. In the context of what we're seeing here is he was getting the people to make a commitment to do what they heard. Just a reminder, if you look back in the book of Exodus before the Ten Commandments were given in chapter 20, Moses was told by God to go tell the children of Israel, I'm going to tell you what I want you to do. I want your commitment to do it even before I tell you what it is you're going to do. And so I've used this illustration before. And a friend comes up to you and says, hey, can you help me this weekend? I got something I want you to do. Well, a good friend's going to say, sure, I'm there. A friend that may not be as good is going to say, what is it? And so the children of Israel didn't ask God what he was going to ask them. Moses got them to give a pledge that they would be obedient even before he told them what the commands were. And so Moses came back before God and said, the people said, we will be obedient to you. So here's the issue. The holiness of God, the God who delivered them, demonstrated his strength and his power over the Egyptian gods, brought them out of the land of Egypt, saved them from slavery, brought them across the sea, brought them to the land of Canaan, sustained them. That's the God that they're going to worship. How could you not be wanting to do whatever he's going to ask you to do based upon what he's already done? And so they make this commitment. This is the same sort of thing we see in Jeremiah. Jeremiah asks the people, saying, are you going to do what God's asked you to do or not? So Ezra is trying to get them to make a commitment. So notice, from Ezra's perspective and the influence that he had, the Jews over time became much more reliable in keeping the law. unlike what they were doing before. And so the redo is not just saying start all over and fall back into what you did before. It's saying start all over and be more faithful than you were the first time. So if you made a mistake, you can start all over again, but don't fall back on what you were doing before. Now it's interesting, and this is the authors of the text that I mentioned to you before. I didn't bring my copy of it, but I showed you the digital copy of from Malachi to Matthew between the Testaments. They note that there was an emphasis on law keeping more so than remembering the covenant that lay behind the law. Now that's going to be critical as we're going forward. That law first mindset, if indeed that's accurate at this point, is going to drive a lot of Jesus' concern with the contemporary religious leaders, because they were so law-centric they forgot mercy. They were so law-centric that they forgot grace. They were so law-centric that they forgot the covenant that God made with Abraham that was 400 plus years before the law. So it's not wrong to keep the law, but it was wrong to assume that the law, keeping the law itself was going to save you, because therefore by the deeds of the law shall no flesh be justified. That's Romans 3:20. Those who think that they are saved by means of the law, they've fallen from grace. That's not just in Romans, that's also in the book of Galatians. So that's going to be an issue during Jesus' ministry. It's also going to be an issue during Paul's ministry, because some people who became Christians were still a little bit too law-centric. All right, they were binding circumcision as a requirement for people to become Christians, and other aspects of the law of Moses. We talked about that yesterday with reference to what takes place in Acts chapter 15. So, notice, this is another thing, and I mentioned this before, so we're going to see more details that's going to flesh out things I only alluded to in passing yesterday. The priesthood is going to fill a vacuum. What vacuum are they going to fill? First, in the period between the Testaments, there's no kings. In fact, there's no kings now, before you get to the period between the Testaments. There are no kings, all right? There's no judges. And the role of prophets, though we see them in Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, once you get past Malachi, there's not any prophets. And so of the three great roles in public life that influence public life, Jeremiah sums them up as the prophets, the priests, and the princes. And by princes, he meant those people who were in the kingly order of things. There are no prophets that are going to continue past this point. There aren't any priests or kings. It's all going to be, princes or kings. It's all going to be the priests. And if we get far enough into it tonight, you're going to drop your jaw if you don't already know some of this stuff about some of the things that the priests got involved in that just made a mess of what's going on in Judah in this period between the Testaments. So when Jesus comes on the scene, before that, when John comes on the scene, they're dealing with a priesthood that's kind of gone rogue. And some of it's their fault. Some of it's because of the political intrigue and subterfuge of nations around them that they allowed to happen. Some of it's a desire for power and influence and wealth. All of those things are coming to play as we get forward in our lesson this evening and tomorrow. But this is what I want us to understand. The seeds of that power issue between Jesus and the religious leaders, between Paul and the Pharisee kind of mindset of the Judaizing teachers, it's sown here. All right. So the Persian kings, one of the things that they did in order to encourage the worship of the people who went back to their land, not just the Jews, but every nation, was they did not make those people pay taxes. All right. So what's one of the I don't want to get political here, but what's one of the criticisms that people have about members of Congress? They have their own health care system. And everybody says, well, why don't they just have what we have? You know, why do they get something special? Well, the priests got something special. What is it? They didn't have to pay taxes. Well, that was a real sticky wicket with a lot of people. That's going to develop when you get to the time of Christ. The zealots, those are the people who couldn't stand outside influence in the country. They weren't very happy that the priests had this kind of deal, that they were exempt from taxes, right? So that plus the Romans used these tax collectors, of whom Matthew, one of the apostles, was, to kind of stick it to people. Not just to collect what the Romans wanted to, but they were known for collecting more to feather their own nest and line their own pockets. All that kind of stuff created tension among different groups in the dynamic that was Israel during the time of Jesus. That's going to come into play now. All right. So when Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah are gone, and the prophets are gone, The only thing that's going to keep them going for the next few hundred years is the general adherence of a population to the law. No Moses there to direct them. All right? And the only thing that's left is what's going to take up the vacuum that we mentioned before, fill the vacuum, and that's the priesthood. Well, what happens when the priesthood goes corrupt? Jeremiah, a righteous prophet, called false prophets to task. Jeremiah 23. Got false prophets who are lying prophets. They steal God's word. Well, how do they steal God's word? One, they didn't preach it. Number two, they didn't live consistently with it. But he also took to task false priests. So who's going to be taking the false priest to task in this period between the Testaments? That's an issue. All right, so allowing the priest not to pay taxes gave credence and legitimacy to what the priests were doing. We like what you're doing. We're going to give you break, no taxes. Okay, they had a favored status, a tax favored status. That's good in one sense. That kept outside influence and interference at bay. That's fine. But negatively, it gave the priests an opportunity to increase their own wealth. The job of being a priest in the Old Testament was not a job that you took to be rich. First, you couldn't take it. You had to be in the right lineage in order to be part of that. We're going to talk about that later. But it's like they used it to take advantage of people once these kind of things kicked in. So that's going to be problematic. That's going to be an issue as we go further. All right. So later, the tax-exempt status of the priest, and this is what I mentioned before, that became a sticking point with people who weren't priests. I can't be a priest because I'm not of the right tribe. And it's not fair that you get this tax break because you're of a certain tribe, and you're going to use that in some way that's not fair to the rest of us. So the zealots, and look at the language here, I put it in quotes because that's the way the authors of this text that we're summarizing in part did, they were violently opposed to taxation of any kind. In-country taxation, and especially country taxation that came from people out of the country, all right? So you people get a break. We don't think that's fair. And so there's a tension that's here. So remember, one of the things that Jesus was challenged with by the religious leaders, they came to put him on the spot and say, hey, is it fair that we should pay taxes to Caesar? Because some of the Jews were the mindset, you don't give Caesar a penny. All right, because Caesar is oppressing us. We've been under the control of the Roman Empire since 63 BC. So by the time they're saying this, it's almost a century. And they had been under the thumb of other nations before that. So that was a religious question. That was a political question. That was an economic question. And for a lot of the Jews, it was a military question because they wanted to drive the Romans out. And that's what the attempt was in 68 AD and following. Some of the zealots attacked a garrison of Roman soldiers in and around the city of Jerusalem. And that's when, quote unquote, all hell broke loose. Because the Roman generals came and they squashed Jerusalem again and destroyed the temple again. And 2,000 years later, not rebuilt. So the first temple, when it was destroyed, it stayed destroyed for 50 years. And then 20 years afterwards, they came back, they rebuilt it, about 70 years total. 2,000 years it hasn't been rebuilt. And the seeds of what prompted that is all the tensions that's going on in the context of the country, not wanting anybody else that's going to influence them. That's going to come into play in the intertestamental period when we get into the Maccabeans and the Hasmoneans.
Didn't the Caesar during this period of time set himself up as a... quote,
that's it's a little bit later. Within a generation of Jesus living, Caligula referred to himself as Dominus et Deus, which meant God, Lord and God, while he was still alive. Generally speaking, they would deify the Caesars after their death. In the area of Asia Minor, during where the churches were in the book of Revelation, there may have been as many as 200 plus places of designated worship for Augustus, the first technical Caesar alone. Some of those people in Asia Minor were more Roman than people in Rome were. They worshiped their emperors, all right? And so that was an issue. How can we do this in paying taxes to these people when they set themselves up as if they're gods, all right? Now, mind you what we're talking about now. Some of the priests are almost going to do the same thing. They don't ask to be worshiped, but they're not only going to assume prerogatives spiritually speaking, they're going to assume prerogatives religiously, spiritually speaking, but also militarily speaking, politically speaking. Some of these guys are going to be kings before we get to the time of Jesus. How did that happen? Lots of problems, all right? So the priests are going to be a major problem by the time we get to the beginning of the New Testament. That's about to develop in the next few years as we go further here. All right, so influence of Nehemiah and Ezra, profound. All right, so we're almost at the end. And we're about to get into the heart of the intertestamental period. You might think it's about time. That's what this class is about. But I want us to set the stage. The stuff that we've been talking about is going to come into play even more as we go forward. All right. So impacted Judah, all right? And impacted for good during the, watch this, the early days. I emphasize during the early days of the restoration period. Well, why did I say that? Because what started didn't keep that way, all right? Very often when God initiates something that he wants, it's not too much further down the road before somebody somewhere thinks, I got a better idea. Maybe we can do it this way. Maybe we can add something to it, take something away from it, change it some way, all right? So they did a lot of good, but what they're going to start is going to be counterbalanced, that is, in opposition to what they started for good during the peace, the time of the intertestamental period. And that's what we want to get into.
You'll need to download one.
Is that my phone?
Yeah, she thought you were talking to her.
I had that happen in a class when I was teaching during my worship, during worship hour at Dahlonega the other day. All of a sudden, my phone started talking to me. I'm going to have to throw that away somewhere so that doesn't happen. What's weird is I talk all the time, and it just chooses all, say, it recognizes your voice. It's a voice-sensitive thing. It's just hilarious that it does it like that. All right, I'm sorry. Let's come back to reality here. So that negative impact that's going to start after Ezra and Nehemiah are gone is going to start in this period of time that we're about to see. All right, so it's going to impact political, social, religious elements. All right, now, let me just mention very quickly that in Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a vision. And we're very familiar with the vision. He sees an image, and it's composed of four different parts. And when Daniel comes and interprets the vision for him, he tells him that the four different parts represent four successive world kingdoms. All right? The first one was Nebuchadnezzar. All right? That's the Babylonian kingdom. That's the people who took Judah and Jerusalem captive. All right? Daniel was in Babylonian captivity, later Persian captivity as the Persians take over. Ezekiel was in Babylonian captivity. Jeremiah prophesied that they're going to be in Babylonian captivity for 70 years. That's the top part of that image. But next, as he goes down, the next part of the image represents the next kingdom. That's the Medo-Persian Empire. That's the kingdom of which Cyrus was the king, who gave them the decree that said, y'all can go back home. All right? The Assyrians not only captured people and spread them all over the place, they were very oppressive to them. The Babylonians were a little bit looser than that. You can do whatever you want as long as you're in captivity in Babylon, but you got to stay here. The Cyrus said, no, you can go back home, but we have control factors. We have satraps and governors going to watch after you. So we're letting you go back home. You don't have to stay in our country, but you're still under our thumb. We still rule the roost here, all right? So that's the next empire. Well, here's the third one in the series, and this is the Grecian Empire, the world of Alexander the Great. So Alexander the Great only lived to be about 33 years, roughly the same age that Jesus was when he died, and he's going to impact the world in such a way that his influence still reaches us today. How can that be? The guy's been dead, you know, for 2,300, 2,400 years. How can his influence still reach us? Well, lots of different ways. One is the culture that he was fond of, had an affinity for, that his dad also had an affinity for, was spread throughout the known world at that time. He was infatuated with Greek culture. So if you look at a map and you see where Macedon is, where his father was the king of Macedonia, and you see where Greece was and you see where Italy is, all in the same general part of the world, the greater Mediterranean area, he was fascinated with Greek culture, and as he conquered the world, and why he did it the way he did, we're going to get into, he took Greek culture and Greek language, Greek literature, Greek arts, Greek philosophy everywhere. By the way, there are three great, I want to be careful here, there are many great Greek philosophers, but three of the most well-known are three that are in an order. If you can remember the word spa, you can remember their names. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, in that order. All right. So Socrates was first. Many of the dialogues of Plato are relating the speeches and interchange between Socrates and others. And then Plato and then Aristotle. So one was a pupil, the other was a pupil of the other. And Aristotle was the last one. Well, Aristotle, the last of those three great philosophers, was a personal mentor and tutor of Aristotle the Great, of Alexander the Great. All right. So his king, His dad, Philip of Macedon, had Aristotle, a great philosopher, teaching Alexander some of the finer points, no doubt, of Greek culture and Greek philosophy and Greek language and art and theater and drama and all that kind of stuff. So his dad already had that inclination. The mentor, the great philosopher Aristotle, was already of that mindset. So Alexander's going to have the same mindset. And so much of Western philosophy was influenced by Greek and Latin or Roman culture. It still impacts us today. Bertrand Russell and Alfred North Whitehead, I think it was Alfred North Whitehead, said, almost all the philosophy today is but a footnote to Plato. What does that mean? Everything that everybody thinks philosophically today, they thought, you know, 2,400 years ago. There's nothing new under the sun, is the way, you know, Solomon put it. His point is that the ideas of Western culture and thought are rooted in Greek culture and Greek philosophy. Much of our political stuff that we do today is rooted in Greek culture. So much of our language is rooted in Greek culture. And by the way, when we're going to get into it, the New Testament was more than likely, a large percentage of it, I say more than likely because some segments were recorded in Aramaic, in large measure written in the Greek language. Why? It was the lingua franca, which was the common tongue of the people of the day. And so Jesus showed an affinity for quoting from the Greek Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, as much as others quoted from the Hebrew. What's the point? Everybody knew about it. How did that happen? How did it happen that in 300 years a whole new language is going to impact what we see during the time of Jesus and John and Paul? That's Alexander's influence, all right? So there is no way we can overstate what Alexander did in his short time, not because he did it himself, but because he introduced ideas to others, and those things took root and they haven't stopped. All right. So Alexander the Great, his son, his dad was a king in Macedonia. He was murdered. And so when his dad was murdered, he had become a regent with his dad when he was 17. He's only 20 years old at the time that his dad was murdered. So during the time that Alexander was alive, when his father was still alive, the Persians, notice that, the Persians had invaded his country at least twice. And his daddy, had he lived long enough, was wanting to retaliate against the Persians. Just a reminder, Nebuchadnezzar, deposed by the Medes and the Persians, all right? Cyrus was a Persian king, Darius and Artaxerxes, all those guys we see mentioned later, they're all from that Medo-Persian empire. And so his father, they were kind of a burr in his saddle. He wanted to do something about it, but his dad died. So Alexander inherited a desire to wreak vengeance on the Persians. And only Alexander does it. His daddy didn't get to. And so, but it was more than that. He didn't want to just exact judgment against them. He wanted to do more. So, watch. He takes control of his own country, Macedonia, native country. He goes to North Africa, goes to the eastern reaches of the Mediterranean. We don't have a map, but if you look at the land of Palestine, roughly the size of New Jersey, mentioned that yesterday, and you look on the western shores of that, you've got Tyre side, you've got the land of Philistia, and on the other side, there's this big sea called the Mediterranean. The eastern Mediterranean, all the nations that surrounded that, Asia Minor, going down to the Sinai Peninsula and North Africa, Libya and Eritrea and Egypt especially, all those are on the eastern parts of the Mediterranean. So he's going to go there. So he's going to conquer even into India, all right, to the Indus River and beyond. So his reach is going to be pretty far. So one of the things that's noted is that the reach of his kingdom reached roughly 20% across the world's distance at that time. That didn't mean he went both north and south, but mostly east and west along the Mediterranean. He conquers a huge swath of what he set out to do. So his was the greatest kingdom that exists from the standpoint of its size between the time of Pericles, who was an Athenian a couple centuries before, until Augustus, that's Octavius, who's the nephew of Julius Caesar, until he begins the Roman Empire. And that's going to continue for some time, long after Augustus comes. So my point is, Alexander the Great was a big deal militarily. But what I want us to get into now is how Alexander's influence is going to impact the next few hundred years until Christ comes. All right? This is going to impact the military. This is going to impact politics. It's going to impact religion. It's going to impact every aspect of social life in the land of Palestine. How? The Greek culture and its influence was practically unstoppable. All right? So here's what came about because of his influence. A large part of the world read and spoke Greek. Those who could read, the literacy rates were low in those days, but people learned to speak Greek. And this is one of the incredible things that helped assist the spread of the gospel. The synagogue worship that kicked into gear, we'll talk about more of that later, was spread in part because Alexander was very fond of the Jews and would populate many areas that he conquered with Jewish people. There's a huge contingent of Jews in Egypt. We talked about that before. It's going to be a large contingent that's going to settle in Alexandria, which is named for him, that became a city of learning, where the Septuagint, the Old Testament translation into Greek, comes about. So Greek language is going to spread everywhere. But it's not just Greek language, it's all the ideas and thinking that go along with that. The political ideas of the Greek city-states, and the concern for things that are greater than mankind, the benefit of lesser peoples who need to be lifted up by their philosophy and the morals and so forth. All of that's going to be impacted, going to create an impact on the world. So writing, literature, art, philosophy, design, architecture, that's all Greek stuff, all right? And so, you know, if you go to the ancient city of Athens and you see the ruins of the Parthenon, they had lots of religious stuff, but massive buildings. And the same thing is going to impact even the culture of Rome. So a lot of things at Rome that was often referred to as more of a Latin culture got things from the Greeks themselves. They're going to come after that. New social institutions, new governments, and forms of government, all right? The idea of democracy and republics, that all developed in ancient Greeks. And so all of those ideas took root in that part of the world, and many of them still exist today. So Mr. Alexander, his dad was ambitious. He affected militarily, diplomatically, politically, and so forth, the areas of Macedonia and Greece. But Alexander did more than his dad, because he was able to conquer so much of the world. So it was his desire, that is his father's, to conquer the Persians, but he didn't get to do it. So Alexander's going to take up the mantle of his father's leadership, but some of his daddy's goals became Alexander the son's goal. He championed Greek culture, he desired to defeat Persia, and he did it. He didn't just want to do it, he got it done. So what motivation Alexander received from his father was augmented, we mentioned this already, by Aristotle, last of the great Grecian triad of philosophers, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. And so he mentored him, schooled him in ancient Greek works of Homer, the dramatist, politics, and Greek thought. So Alexander's not just a whoop-everybody general. He's a guy who had an intellect, and he was a guy who wanted to spread what he thought was good for people intellectually, culturally, to the rest of the world. So his dad dies, he consolidates his rule over the Greek city-states and starts to conquer the rest of the world. Starts in Asia Minor, area that we would know to be Turkey, and do his early... Once he left, this is interesting, once he left Macedonia to start conquering the world, he never got back home. Because he didn't stop conquering the world. He died en route to these things. He developed a fever and wasn't able to live beyond this, but he never came back home. So once he started the conquest, he never finished the conquest because he died in pursuit of all the things he wanted to do. So all these conquests that we're talking about that he did militarily are incredible, but we're going to see the residual impact of what he did intellectually and culturally that's going to have an even greater impact, and it's going to impact the Jews in the land of Palestine. All right? So let's jump ahead, and Alexander's dead. Alexander's empire was divided among four generals. We're only going to mention two of them because those are the most significant ones. The Ptolemies, who are going to be in control of the region in North Africa, known as Egypt, obviously, and the Seleucids, Seleucus Nicator. All the people after this are going to be referred to as Seleucids because they're successors of one of the generals who's going to take control of Syria. And so what's interesting is there's a dynamic that's in play. Again, we alluded to this the other day. Israel, in the land of Palestine, is in an incredible position geographically between major empires to their south and west, Egypt primarily, and empires that are to their north and the east. That's Assyria, Babylon, Syria, and all these other nations, and troublesome spots like Moab and Edom. And so they're in the middle of everything. It's like they can't escape anything, because any world empire wants to do something, conquer another part of the world, they're going to go stomping through the land of Palestine at some point. And because of the topography and the geography of the land, there are limited routes that they could take, simply because of the terrain. And so the Jews are going to have to get used to that. So these two leaders, Ptolemy and Seleucid, And notice they make reference that the end of the reign of the Ptolemies goes down to the Cleopatra that we're very familiar with, the famous Cleopatra that was involved in a romance with Mark Antony that involved the death of the first man that was called Caesar, though he didn't have the same role that his nephew did, Julius Caesar. And the other one in Syria, which is where Damascus and Antioch were. So, notice, each of these two guys, the Ptolemies, one of Alexander's generals, and Seleucid and those successors, both of them wanted to control the land of Palestine. Why? They knew what I just mentioned, trade routes, central place, and because where it was geographically, if you can control that, you can control lots of other things in the area. All right? It's like, this is a pivotal place. We need to. This is where we need to hang our hat. So you're going to see lots of stuff going on, ping-ponging between different political leaders during this period of time. All right. Geographical location, middle of the Eastern Empire, the land of Egypt, many highways, controlling access to its thoroughfares. This is the land of Palestine, where all the great characters that we know from the period of Moses going forward to the time of David and Jesus, and of course, that's where they all live. So, Ptolemy's going to die. Remember, he's the first of a series of rulers in Egypt that are going to still have the same kind of goals. We want that land. We want to control that land. We want to control the people in that land. All right? So others are going to do the same thing. Remember, there were a lot of Jews who fled to Egypt when the Babylonians were coming to Jerusalem. Jeremiah said, you know, some of you are going to die in Egypt. They said, no, we're going to be okay. And some of them did die in Egypt, but they established a toehold there. They built their own temple system of worship. And there were a lot of Jews that were there. And many of them are going to be taken there and encouraged to grow because of the influence of Alexander the Great. So, not all the Jews that fell in Judah stayed up in Babylonian captivity or stayed in the land. Some went to Egypt. We talked about that before. All right. So notice, they're going to be used as cultural centers because of their nature and so forth, and because Alexander favored them in key cities. Alexandria, we mentioned this already. It was there that the Hebrew Old Testament was translated into Greek, known as the Septuagint. It has reference to the number of writers, 70 writers. LXX is the Latin number for Roman numeral for 70. That was a translation that starts in the second century before the time of Christ, that was so popular by the time Christ on the scene that so many people were citing scriptures of the Old Testament from the Greek translation rather than the Hebrew. That didn't mean one was bad, but they were not identical from the standpoint of people's awareness of them or the wording and so forth. But like I said, Jesus cited it as well. There's more to it than what we just said. Commonly used among the Jews during the first century. So at some point during this Ptolemy who died, he controlled the land of Palestine, but he wasn't able to keep it going forever. Now, Josephus, let's talk about him. He's a key man that we're going to mention later. Josephus was involved in the rebellion against Rome starting at about 68 and going forward. And I realize what time it is. We need to take a break for the first class. So let me get through and finish this and we'll come back to this. Let me just say, you could study this forever and learn more stuff every time you study it. It's kind of like studying the Bible. And I'm not saying this takes the place of the Bible, but this sets the stage for what we're going to see in the New Testament. So Josephus is a historian that lives roughly a generation after the time of Christ, who was an adult roughly Christ's age at the time that the Romans came to attack the city of Jerusalem. And through a series of circumstances, not going to go into all the detail, he endears himself to the Romans and he becomes kind of the official history guy documenting what Rome's about. So he does a lot of things writing for the Romans, but he also does a lot of stuff writing about Jewish history. And so a lot of what we know about this particular period of time was recorded by Josephus, who knew many first-hand resources, primary sources, and so forth, and documents a lot of these details. So he tells us that Antiochus, and you're going to see that name mentioned multiple times because there's several of them. There's an Antiochus, the third, fourth, all the way down to the seventh. He is one of the leaders who continues the Seleucid Empire. Remember, two major generals are talking about. The Ptolemies were in Egypt, and the Seleucids are in Syria. Antiochus doesn't have the name Seleucus or Seleucid, but he's in that successor line in Syria. And so he's going to be significant. He's going to take control from one of the latter Ptolemies. Remember, Ptolemy's like Pharaoh, the name, it's like president. Who's the president? Well, they're all presidents. One president, next president, next president. We call them 42, 43, 44, 45, whatever. Here, they've got 3, 4, 5. So when we, before we get to the end of the study, we're going to see an Antiochus number 7. All right? So we're not up to that point yet. And so according to this, Josephus says, this guy, remember, they're vying for power and this control of this area. Antiochus is going to get control of this area and was welcomed by the Jews. That's one of them. Now, here's what's interesting. We're going to see, now notice, here's what's critical for us to understand. The guys who dominate the land of Palestine often tell us the land of Canaan, where the Jews are after they come back, they often dictate what the Jews can and can't do with reference to worship. So remember, no king, no judges, you don't have continuing prophets during this period of time of the intertestamental period. And so the priests are the filling the vacuum kind of people, but they can't resist all these people who are coming against them militarily or politically. So if the Egyptians take control, they can impose their will on them, say, you can't do this anymore. All right? And so if the Syrians, the Seleucids, take control and they say, we don't want you to do this anymore. Hey, this is our religion. We were released by the Medo-Persians and we were told we could practice our religion as we see fit. Guess what? Those people ain't in power anymore. The Grecians who follow them, they're not in power anymore. We're in power. So guess what we do? We can tell you what you can and can't do. So here is a huge situation that changes multiple times during this period of history. What they could and could not do from the standpoint of keeping up the redo of the priestly system and the temple system was determined in part by who was in control and what those people would let them do. Again, don't want to get into contemporary politics, but if you go to the country of France, France is a very secular society, and they want everybody to assimilate. And so they don't care what your religion is. You've got to be like everybody else. And so they're not very tolerant of people who don't blend in and assimilate to what they want them to do. And this is why you're going to see lots of stuff that's going on in Europe as a whole. There's all kinds of nationalistic stuff that are going on there, as it is in this country, in which people are very pro their country, and they're not very happy about people who come in from other places. Well, here, Antiochus is allowing the Jews to do so much as long as they don't go so far. And that's going to change as we go a little bit further. So the freedom to worship God as God wanted them to worship God, going back to the time of Sinai, to the redo during the time of Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, some of that's going to be lost during this period between the Testaments. And this is why everything that Jesus said was so politically sensitive. The Jews were in a relatively calm place when the Romans were in control. And you got this guy who's perceived by the religious leaders as a rabble-rouser. And here's what they think. If we don't stop this man, referring to Jesus, he's going to bring the Romans against us. And we know what the Romans can do. We're already under their thumb. And not only that, watch this. He says he will remove us from our place. We will lose our position and status in the social strata of everything. And so people were concerned about what Jesus was doing, not because Jesus was telling them you can't practice your religion that way, but if what Jesus was doing garners enough attention, the Romans are going to come, and they'll stop everything, and then we'll be back to what we dealt with during this period we're about to discuss, because they couldn't practice their religion freely. If nothing else, as things were rocking along during the time of John and Jesus, the Romans didn't stop the Jews from practicing their religion. They were afraid that this Jesus guy is going to change things, and we've been through that for the last 500 years. So what's going to go on here is going to impact the attitude of Jewish people, saying, this is what we've been dealing with for years. We haven't had a king for hundreds of years. We haven't had prophets for hundreds of years. We are at a relative calm now. Don't rock the boat. All right? So you can see how that's going to be problematic. All right. We went a little bit past the time that we needed to in the first hour. So we'll stop and take a break for a few minutes and I'll try to keep on track about the length of time going forward. So I get excited about this stuff. I don't know about you.
This is really where it talks in the New Testament in the fullness of time.
Yes. That's part of what's going on here when everything was just the way God wanted it to be. All of this stuff, the good, the bad, is going to come to fruition in what Jesus is going to do. And the circumstances, militarily, politically, language, culturally, whatever, is going to be just right for the spread of the gospel. And that was anticipated. All right, let's take a break.
And there are goodies out there again. I forgot a couple of things last night, but they're there tonight.
Now, this document you've gone over is not out in the resources.
It will be. It will be.